Welcome to Trojans Taco Tea. My name is Alyssa Quancha, and I'm here with Rob Russo, and we're broadcasting live from the University of Southern California, Division of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. And today, we're kicking off a new series of episodes about the dilemma surrounding disability, which is a very rich and complex topic.
I'm very excited about this topic, too, by the way, because for the past semester, I've been studying disability with Dr. Anne Neville Jan, who is one of the people you interviewed for this podcast.
Yeah, it's perfect.
But before we really dig deeper into this, let's rewind and talk a little bit about what occupational therapy is in case someone's tuning in interested more in disability and doesn't really know what occupational therapy is. So to me, when I think of occupational therapy, I talk about anything that someone does that is meaningful, that occupies their time. That's really what occupation is. So an occupational therapist then works with individuals throughout the lifespan, whether they've had an illness, an injury, or any kind of difficult life circumstances, to help them get back to those meaningful occupations, those things that they want to do or would like to do with their time. And so that's what an occupational therapist does.
Tell us who you are and what you do.
I'm Anne Neville Jan, and I'm the Associate Chair for Faculty and Curriculum at USC in the Division of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. And I do a lot of things. I'm an administrator. I oversee all the curriculum and work with faculty, hiring search committees. I teach, and I do a little bit of research.
So let's talk about the classes that you teach. What are you teaching this semester?
This semester, I'm teaching a class called Clinical Reasoning, and it's a class about, it's not so much about what to do in the moment with the patient, but what therapists think about, and it's about empathy, I'd say, having empathy and using that empathy in treatment. And the other class I teach is called Disability Occupations and Healthcare, and it's taught to undergraduate students, who some may be OT going to occupational therapy and some may not. So that's an interesting class.
I bet, with a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, and they come into my class with a lot of the stereotypes about disability. You know, that it's a tragedy, it's a horrible thing. Everybody who has a disability would want to be cured. And so it's fun to see them change as they learn new perspectives. It's really exciting to see that change. One of my students said, I showed a video of different people with disabilities who are poets and artists and performers, and they were talking about what it means to have a disability. And someone in the class commented, I've never seen so many people in 1 hour. I've seen more people in that 1 hour who have a disability than I've seen in my whole life. So you know that the class is just all about that. So
yeah,
that's what's exciting.
So maybe this would be a good time to talk about your history and kind of how you got into OT and your experience.
Okay. Well, you'd think that, well, I have spina bifida, so that's a congenital issue that occurs in the first 3 months in the womb. And they told my parents I wouldn't walk, I would be developmentally delayed, I'd have hydrocephalus and all these worst case scenario things. And back in the 1950s, that was, you know, they hadn't developed the shunt. So if I did have hydrocephalus, I was not going to make it. So, and 90% of infants born with spina bifida have hydrocephalus. So I was lucky. So I, you know, one of my mom's friends who had polio said, have your daughter be educated, get as much education as she can. So that's what my parents did. They just kept me going in school, and and then I never had occupational therapy. I had physical therapy, but I read about it in a book, and it sounded great to combine science and art, and those were my two interests. So I volunteered at Johns Hopkins in their OT department, and I loved it. I worked with adolescents who were hospitalized because they had anorexia, and so I helped run a group, and I loved it. So that's how I went into OT.
Nice. And so when you're teaching your class, you can speak from experience and talk about your personal perspectives on disability.
Right. I wasn't always able to do that. It took me time to feel comfortable in my own body and be able to talk to students, but in the past, I'd say 15 years, I feel that's something big that I bring to class. And I talk about it freely, and it's helped me. I love to teach, but part of teaching is also learning, so I'm always learning with students, and I'm always experiencing new things, so.
So one of the things that came up in our classes is proper terminology. You know,
right.
We're talking about a lot of different medical conditions, and something that has been really important for some of our professors is using person-first language.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask, what to you is person-first language?
Well, I think person-first language is that you're a person, and then with a disability. Like I'm Ann Neville Jan, who has spina bifida. And I think that for people who haven't experienced a disability or, you know, are going out there in the world, I think it's really important to promote that person first, because you can get into the habit of calling people their disability, like autistic children or...
That total hip replacement in 204.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it becomes kind of, once you get out there in the clinic, sometimes students get socialized into doing that. And I think you don't have to call out other people for what they say, but when they'll hear you say Joan in 206, who has a hip replacement, if you keep saying it in person first language, they're going to notice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we don't always have to feel, oh, I should correct that person, you know, and say not to do that. So I think by example we can show and what, you know, the kind of language that should be used. And I think that's the default. If you're ever not sure, always use person first. Situations where you might not hear person first is in the disability community. People don't care so much in terms of, you know, I'm a disabled person and that's who I am. And it's more of like putting it in people's faces so that they get, you know, recognized. And it's a civil rights issue. And so it's, you know, you might hear that. And I might say, in some instances, in some venues, I'm a disabled person. But I wouldn't want somebody else to call me a disabled person.
Right.
So it's not always one way. It's, nothing is ever one way.
Right. So I guess talking about, instead of the terminology, the reasoning behind coming up with it is more about recognizing people for who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, their identity includes their disability.
Right.
But not limiting your perception of that person to what that disability is, or stereotyping a disability, because as we've learned, every diagnosis is different from person to person. It's a case-by-case basis.
I have a story, and I went to see a physical therapist, and a few months later, that physical therapist saw my husband, and my husband said to him, "Oh, you must know my wife. She's a professor in occupational therapy." And he thought and thought, and he goes, "I don't think so." And he said, "Her name's Ann Nevelejan." He thought and thought and thought, "No, I don't think I met her." So my husband came home and he said, "You know," he said, "he didn't know you." And I said, "Tell him I had spina bifida." So the next time my husband saw the physical therapist, he said, "My wife said you would know her because she has spina bifida." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, I know her." So, you know, he knew me more because I had spina bifida than who I was as a person.
Right.
So I thought that was such a really good example.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly how to get him to remember me.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's a shortcut. It's a thing that, why can't the most notable thing about me be that I'm a professor in occupational therapy rather than I have spina bifida?
Right.
Or both.
Another thing I wanted to bring up, I mentioned to Tara Perry about this episode and coming to talk to you, and she was like, "Oh, have you guys seen the video of Dr. Nevelejan in the 70s talking about..." And I was like, "No, but..."
You will.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you maybe briefly, what was the video for?
Well, I was in New York. I was a therapist, and I was at home in the evening watching a TV show. It was NBC News Magazine, and it was about spina bifida. And I thought, oh, it perked me up, and I started listening. And there was one sentence, and I had an opportunity to see the clip again. One sentence that a child with spina bifida can lead a normal and productive life, and the rest was doom and gloom. They talked about how the child would have bladder and bowel problems, and how at various times this mother had to put a cath tube to drain the urine. The way they describe things, you know.
Very dramatic.
Yeah, and I was horrified. And so I've never done this before. And I wrote a letter and said, "I have spina bifida," and I think I still had a letter somewhere. And, you know, I lead a productive life. I'm a occupational therapist. And I, you know, went on, and I date, and I did blah, blah, blah. And your show was very negative about spina bifida. So anyway, it was more than that. So I got a call the next day from the producers, and they asked me if I would, since I was in New York, it was easy, if I would come down and, you know, at the end of their show, they always have clips of people talking about their previous show, their comments. So I went down, and actually the show was about, it was about spina bifida, but the main theme was that there was now a test in utero to determine if child had spina bifida. So the idea is that, well, now you can have this test and you can find out
you don't have to have
this child with spina bifida. It's such a tragedy. So anyway, so I went down and I was nervous, and you know, they had a camera on me and a light, and I had my own person, and she was sitting there with me and asking me to talk about this topic. And she said, "You sound, when you're saying this, you're smiling." And she said, "Aren't you upset about it?" And I go, "Well, yeah, this is kind of my personality. I tend to smile." And she said, "Well," you know, she really got me into the feeling of how strong.
Angry.
Yeah, be angry about this. So anyway, so I thought, I worried then about how they would put this clip in with other clips, because you know what they can do, they can arrange it. So I actually had the last word. There were three or four different people responding, and I'm not going to give it away for you because you'll see it in class. And so what's very dramatic when students see it is that I'm young. I'm 30 years younger, and I have curly hair and big earrings. But that was I got on TV and I said, you know, I had spina bifida and I'm glad my parents didn't have to make this choice. Because that's what the show is called, The Terrible Choice.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that intense? And this issue is still going on.
Right.
People don't think that there's... I sat next to a woman on a plane the other day and we were talking and I said, I had spina bifida, and she looked at me and she said... That still exists?
Really?
Yeah, because the message is if you take folic acid, you won't have a child with spina bifida. So, we kind of got off the language part, but...
Well, it's still... we're talking about disability, because it's not just about the language. We're talking about people and who they are.
Right.
And trying to break down, like, in your class, you have students that say, oh, I've never seen more than a handful of, you know,
people
with disabilities in my entire life. And maybe it's because they aren't recognizing that, oh, yeah, John, who walks with a little bit of a limp, he has a disability, but you don't recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you think of him as a John.
Mm-hmm.
And for you, disability is like, oh, okay, this person is no longer... able to function at the same level as everyone
mm-hmm.
else. They
mm-hmm.
can't live their life normally.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want... What it comes down to is we don't want to surround all of this stigma around
mm-hmm.
the idea of disability, which I think goes back to these disability movements that you
mm-hmm.
talk about. Like,
mm-hmm.
people are okay with who they are, and they want who they are to be enough, and they want to push it in your face.
Right. Just like any other movement, you know, like... the gay, lesbian, transgender movement, you know? I mean, that's really going on now, and, you know, the whole civil rights around those issues. It's somewhat different with disability, but it's the same, you know, same in a lot of ways. We're not less than, because, you know, we have a disability, although in society people wouldn't necessarily say that, but they think it's a bias that they've grown up with. It's a stigma that's been there forever. We're reading in my disability class Irving Goffman's book called Stigma, and that was written in 1963 and as a text for sociology, and many of the issues are still very prevalent today. I mean, yeah, we have curb cuts, we have parking spaces, we have ramps, but that's not just what it's about.
Right.
It's much deeper.
Like, in what ways?
Because it goes down into what people actually believe about, you know, disability, and is it a tragedy, you know, There were fights about the ADA. Why would somebody not support the ADA? I mean, I think on the one side, I mean, you have to take everybody's perspective. Small businesses think that it would take away their rights because, you know, they have to pay money to put in a ramp. But sometimes it's just an easy fix. And you know, and there are people with disabilities who go around and try to sue, but it's not the majority. So, you know, I think it's important to take both sides, but it's going to take a while to catch up. So we need the laws to protect us.
And what's the goal, ultimately?
The goal is just to live in the world like everybody else. And have equal access like everybody.
And I think what taking that a step further is without having to change who I am.
Right. Like get a job, be able to get a job and not be discriminated against because you have a disability.
Right.
And that's hard to hard to know if somebody's discriminating, you know? Mm. That's a hard one to, but.
Yeah. So, I guess I wanted to talk about that quote you bring up in class. It's not me that's disabled, it's the building or it's the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Right. It's not... it's the social environment that is disabling. It's not... I'm not disabled. I mean, we all have a disability, but, you know, something that...
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's normal.
Right.
We could go and talk about what's normal, but anyway, but it's... For me, it's like... for example, last year, I had to wear a boot on my foot, and I couldn't walk across the other campus to get to my class, and I know they had these carts, and but they didn't run at 8:30 when I needed them to pick me up, so it became this big to-do to get them to pick me up, and they did after, you know, I mean, they did. I mean, one or two times I was left in the evening and I hobbled to my car. But you know, it should be easier.
Mm-hmm.
That was disabling me. I didn't feel disabled until I couldn't get the class.
Right.
So should I go on disability? I don't want to go on disability. I want to do my class. So there's a way to do that.
Right.
So...
Another thing that you often say, I'm not disabled, you're just temporary able-bodied.
Oh, yeah, I like that one, huh? That's from, I still can't think of, Irving Zola. He was a disability activist, and he has since, he was one of the first independent living centers in Boston. And anyway, but he liked to do that, to turn it around. If somebody is calling us disabled, then call them temporarily able-bodied or momentarily able-bodied, because, you know, you never know.
Right, and then everybody gets older.
Yeah, everybody gets older. So
you lose your hearing, and then all of a sudden,
mm-hmm, anything.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Vision, walking.
Yeah.
And at my generation, there's a lot of us, so we're going to need a lot of occupational therapists to be out there working with us, supporting public policy to, you know, get more accessible buses and transit and ways to get around, because we're not going to sit home.
Right.
We're going to be out there, so.
Well, and the point is, like, okay, yeah, I may not be able to walk 200 yards consistently, but that doesn't mean that once I get there,
mm-hmm,
there's not some things that I want to do.
Right.
Or that it's not worth it for me to get to that point.
Right.
Like, I have my own interests, I have my own.
Mm-hmm.